Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here. She just said, I was with you all in 2015, I think, and it feels like it was a really long time ago because a lot has happened since then. But one of the things, unfortunately, that hasn't changed is the war on terror is still ongoing. And, you know, thinking back now, this is 20 years. 20 years ago, I was here in New York City, where I'm speaking to you from now. And I saw the Twin Towers collapse right in front of me. I was living across the street. And if I can link between that moment and this past summer where I was here in New York, what one of the things that links it to is the complete and utter disregard that my country's rulers and the people who run this world have for ordinary human beings. In the war on terror and everything that sprung out of the ruins of the World Trade Center show that, as well as what happened in New York over the last year. I mean, we have had here in the city, the wealthy basically abandon this city and to the poor and the working class with no social services. I was spent a lot of time up in public housing projects where there was bodies coming out of rooms every single day. And it really looked like a lot of the reporting that I had done overseas and looked at, like, it looked a lot like the receiving end of the U.S. wars. So we're still trying to come out of this here in New York. But I think it's a good time to think about the legacy of the war on terror because of this intimate link that here in New York has with this war, unfortunately. It's been 20 years, as I said, and I could start by talking about the tens of thousands or the hundreds of thousands of lives that have been destroyed by American imperialism. I can start by talking about the proliferation of drones and the violation of popular sovereignties, the ways in which so many Afghan and Pakistani families lie awake at night when they hear the thrum of a drone overhead. I could talk about Guantanamo or Iraq, all of which you may know a bit about. So instead, I want to talk to you today about a road. This is a road. It's about 200 miles in length in southern Afghanistan, and it connects two U.S. bases, from Kandahar province to Uruzgan province. And as roads go, it's not, you know, before 2001, it wasn't a very important road in Afghanistan. But because there were two U.S. bases there for many years, U.S. troops used to send supplies between the two bases on this road every single day, thousands and thousands of tons of material. And Taliban insurgents would try to attack the convoys. So over time, the U.S. started to hire local warlords to protect this road. One of the warlords they hired was a man named Matiullah, who some of you may know. Matiullah was a very powerful warlord who was actually a friend of the Australians and a friend of the ADF. And some of his men actually came to Australia to get trained. So Matiullah was tasked with protecting this highway, and he would charge $2,000 or $3,000 per truck that he protected with his gunmen, right? And now you can imagine in a given day, there was hundreds of trucks. So he was making in a month, millions of dollars. In just one month, when I was there, when I was tracking him one month, for example, he made over 6 million in a single month just from protecting trucks. This in an area where the average income is probably $2,000 or $3,000 for an entire year. So Matiullah was getting extraordinarily wealthy, and the U.S. were getting their convoys protected. But he wasn't just protecting the trucks. He was also tasked with trying to clean up the area of quote-unquote bad guys. So he would go and do raids. He would do night raids, kick down people's doors, and a number of atrocities that he left in his wake. I'll just give you an example of one atrocity that I reported on, although there's many others like this, which is there was a religious seminary near this road for young boys between the ages of like 3 to 15. Matiullah's men broke into the seminary one day, accused them of being Taliban sympathizers, and summarily executed all of them. He took boys as young as 3 or 4 and shot them in the head. Some of his men raped some of the boys and left them to die. All of this he did in the name of fighting terror, in the name of fighting terrorism. And this is important because on the one hand, yeah, I'm describing atrocity, and what war is a series of atrocities, and American wars especially are atrocities, right? But the way in which this atrocity came about, I think, signals something about what the war on terror actually was and is, and how it is different from some of the previous American imperial endeavors. How it's the same is the people on the end, people on the receiving end suffer extraordinarily. But there are ways in which it's different. I think it's important for us to think about how it's different so we can better understand how we might be able to fight these wars, to stop these wars. So I want to highlight three ways in which the war on terror is fundamentally different from previous American wars. The first is, as I mentioned with this road, all of the protection is being done by local commanders and local warlords, not American soldiers. Afghanistan is a country of about 30 million people. Today, there's around 5,000 U.S. soldiers. For the last 10 years, for the most part, there's been around 5,000, 6,000 U.S. soldiers. Most of them are special forces. At the height of the Afghan war, there was 100,000 soldiers. This is during Obama's surge. But there's never been that many troops on the ground. Compare this to, let's say, Vietnam. Okay, so Vietnam in the 60s had also a population of around 30 million people. In 1968, the U.S. had 500,000 soldiers on the ground in Vietnam. And then if you add the South Vietnamese army, they had 800,000 South Vietnamese soldiers. So you're talking about over a million and a half men under arms. It's an extraordinary degree of militarization. Compare that to Afghanistan, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 U.S. soldiers, maybe 20, 30, 40,000 U.S. proxies. And that is the footprint of the U.S. So it's an extraordinarily light footprint. The same goes for all the other theaters of the war on terror today. And there's many, even in Iraq. At the height, there was 150, 200,000 soldiers in Iraq. But that was for a brief moment. Today, there's only a few thousand soldiers in Iraq. Syria, there's probably less than 1,000 soldiers. Somalia, et cetera. Most of this is being conducted by special operations forces. And this is an important point, which I'll get back to later. So that's the first way in which the current war on terror, is different from previous American wars. The second way is that the reason why the U.S. is able to get away with so few soldiers on the ground is that they outsource most of the key functions of fighting a war to proxies. So they outsource logistics, supplying all these things to local fighters like Matiula. They also outsource a lot of the killing to these people, too. So while there's 5,000 U.S. soldiers on the ground, there's tens of thousands of mercenaries that are being paid directly or indirectly by the U.S. government and by the CIA who are running around. And some of them are no more than death squads. So they are able to outsource a lot of the functions that the U.S. military pre let's say 2001 or in the Vietnam era, functions that used to be done by U.S. soldiers. So, you know, when convoys were being sent from point A to point B in Vietnam, it was being protected by U.S. soldiers. Now, the third difference between the current wars and the previous ones, and this is a little bit counterintuitive and surprising, even to me when I looked into it, which is that these wars, from the perspective of the American ruling class, are actually quite cheap. Okay, now, from the perspective of ordinary people, they're extraordinarily expensive, right? The U.S. has spent billions of dollars in Afghanistan, up to, I think, $1 trillion total, which is extraordinary. And that's money that can be used for human need, for basic human services, instead of going into war. And that's obscene. But if you look at it from the perspective of the U.S. ruling class, it actually isn't a very big expenditure, not just because the United States is the most powerful fiscal entity in human history. That's part of it. But I mean, if you look at, for example, the U.S. federal budget. So in the last year, 15% of the budget went to defense. That's 15% too high, if you ask me, you know, but that's just 15% that went to defense. 60% went to social services for the U.S. Moreover, the money they go, whether it's for social services or for defense, it's all taxpayer dollars, right? But when it goes to defense, those taxpayer dollars get cycled back to corporations through what we call here the Beltway Bandits, through the military-industrial complex, et cetera. So in other words, from the perspective of the American ruling class, spending on the military is not is cheap because it doesn't actually take away from the business class, from the capitalist class. The money that's taken from taxpayers gets funneled back to businesses through subcontracting, et cetera, unlike money spent for social services. All of that means that the U.S., even though the U.S. and other neoliberal countries are always talking about fiscal responsibility and trying to winnow the budget, they're able to spend large sums on the military and it not actually affect their pocketbook, so to speak. So these three features, okay, number one, a light footprint. Number two, a lot of the killing and a lot of the support services are outsourced to local actors. Number three, from the perspective of the U.S. elite, that these are more or less cheap wars. These have consequences beyond just the death and devastation of the people on the receiving end. three important consequences that I'd like to highlight. The first consequence is, think about it. You don't have a lot of soldiers on the ground. That means not a lot of body bags coming back home to the U.S., right? Now, you have massacres. The U.S. is committing massacres. Or I know in Australia, for example, this must be in the news now that the Australian Defense Forces were involved in, also special forces were involved in war crimes in Uruzgan, right? But for every war crime that the ADF committed or the special forces committed, there was 10 committed by their proxy forces that don't make the news. Okay, so in a nutshell, the U.S. is also outsourcing its massacring too. And that's very important because back in Vietnam, you know, when we had images of war crimes and other horrible atrocities coming in on the evening news. Today, yes, if the U.S. commits a horrible crime, it may make it to the news, but it's not, Mattiola's crimes don't make it to the news. And he's paid for and funded and exists. He's a creature of the United States and Australia. He wouldn't exist without these two countries, right? In addition, there's no fiscal pressure to try to end these wars. So all of this together, what I'm trying to build to is the point that the conditions exist for war to be a permanent state of being. So unlike the earlier wars, which were discrete episodes, you know, the Vietnam War from 1960 to 1975 or the Korean War, there are all sorts of pressures. Of course, there are external pressures, which is an anti-war movement, but there was also internal pressures, internal reasons why these wars couldn't just go on forever. But what the United States was able to do, and in large part they did this in response to the events of the 1960s and 1970s, when the U.S. lost the Vietnam War, they lost it for three reasons. The first is because of the resistance of the Vietnamese. The second is because of basically an uprising in the U.S. military. And the third is because of a powerful anti-war movement at home in the United States. And what the U.S. brass did after that was try everything they could to never be in those conditions again, right? So one, they ended the draft. Two, they tried to change their way of engaging in warfare to try to outsource as much as possible, to privatize. In other words, beginning in the 1970s and really after 2001, you saw the turn towards a neoliberal form of warfare. In a neoliberal in the most elemental sense, for example, if you want U.S. soldiers to protect this road, it's going to cost a lot more at the end of the day than it's going to cost to have Mattiola's guys to protect it, because not only because of a salary for American soldier, but the benefits, et cetera, right? So in neoliberal, even in the sense that you have the globalization of a type of labor and you're replacing, you're taking local labor and using it to replace American labor, right? In all of these ways, the neoliberal nature of the war on terror, I think, has been one of the reasons it's allowed it to become a forever war, a war of permanence. This is the first important consequence of the changes post 2001. The second important consequence is that this is a war on terrorism. Okay, and terrorism is even though the word itself has existed for hundreds of years, the way it's been used after 9/11, after 2001, really is a new type, what I would argue is a new type of political tool, a new tool of repression that has not ever existed before. Why? Because terrorism historically has been a tactic. And it's been a tactic that's been used by guerrillas, by states, by narodniks, you know, people could debate whether it's a good or bad tactic. Usually it's a terrible tactic, right? But it was a tactic. After 9/11, terrorism shifted from becoming a tactic to being a type of person. So you have a war on terrorism, which before 9/11 would have made no sense. It's like saying World War II is a war on Blitzkrieg, right? It doesn't make any sense. But once you say that terrorism is a type of person, then you say that there's a type of person in which the rules no longer apply. All whatever rules you may have, which is the international human rights law or, you know, the laws of war, whatever you may have, the rules no longer apply because these people are beyond the pale of civilization. This is the idea inherent in terrorism as a tactic. And because of that, it has become a tool, a remarkably effective tool for repressive governments everywhere, not just the U.S. and the war on terror, but other repressive governments. So when millions of Syrians rose up for democracy, Bashar al-Assad called them terrorists and used that to justify killing them. When the Sri Lankan government conducted ethnic cleansing and quasi-genocide in the northern part of Sri Lanka against Tamils, they called it fighting terrorism. So terrorism is a remarkable tool for repression that comes out of this shift. And the third important consequence, and I'll begin to wrap up here, the third important consequence for the war on terror is democracy. Now, I mentioned that Assad used the language of terrorism to try to crush a democratic uprising. It's not just in other countries that we've seen this, but of course, but in the United States as well. The U.S. today is far less democratic than it was 20 years ago. There's been a gutting of civil liberties. There's been a whittling away of various democratic norms. There's been mass surveillance. There's been the militarization of the police. You can go on. And I'm sure Diana will talk about some of this. But the point is that the discourse of terrorism that the war on terror made available has helped whittle away democratic freedoms for people around the world, both on the side of those who are waging the wars and those who are on the receiving end of the war. So I just want to wrap up. I think I'm over time, so I'll just try to wrap up quickly here. But just a couple of points. One is, I said that the war on terror is different from previous modes of American fighting, and it's important for us to understand. It doesn't mean that war will always be this way. Okay. For example, the U.S. elite wants to pivot its imperial ambitions towards China and towards Asia. And you can imagine if they did that this type of very light footprint, neoliberal type of war is not going to cut it, right? They're going to need large standing armies and a much more conventional approach to war, possibly. If they do need that, then it's a question. What does that mean? Are they going to have to confront the neoliberalization of the military? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. The second point is, Eugene Debs, for example, said very famously that the master classes have waged the wars and the working classes are the ones who fought the wars. That's still true today, but it's less true, at least in the American wars on terror. It's less true today because what you have is a master class that still wages the wars, and then you have officers who have college degrees and drones are dropping bombs on people. I'm exaggerating a little bit. You still have working class people in the infantry, et cetera. But this is an important thing to contend with, and I would say, and this is open for discussion, this is part of the reason why we haven't seen a powerful anti-war movement in the last 20 years. However, that doesn't mean that we can't see a powerful anti-war movement, because as I mentioned, there is a link between the violence that's done overseas and the degradation of democracy and rights that are at home. And it's up to us to make the link between those two to show people that these wars that are being done in our name are not in our interest. Thank you.
I think that it's hard to follow that because that's such a sort of elegant sort of summary, really, of what's happened in terms of how the wars have been conducted, going back to the beginning of the war on terror after the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. So what I want to do is something a bit different, is really to talk about how this has changed the world in the West. I mean, it fits in very much with what Anand said. I think we're nearly 20 years on from the invasion of Afghanistan, and we're in a situation where here in Australia, as Anand mentioned, and actually he's done a lot of the work to reveal these atrocities, Australian SAS soldiers are being exposed for war crimes that they committed there. The WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, faces possible extradition to the United States on espionage charges for exposing the crimes of empire. And I think sort of trying to integrate the two aspects, the two sides, if you like, of the war on terror, that it subjected the Middle East to mass slaughter. I love that phrase, the neoliberalisation of warfare and all the horrors that are encapsulated in that. The stoking of sectarian divisions amid societal collapse and so on. But I think as well it's worth just going through some of a brief history of how the war on terror was not only felt in the horrors visited on the countries that were invaded and occupied, but it had a particular effect in the West. The legacy has been virulent anti-Muslim racism, mass surveillance, the suppression of civil liberties, and a series of political challenges for the left that I want to spend a bit of time on as well. And I think one of the first things out of the war on terror is that it raises the question of who are the bad guys? Because, the common sense is the bad guys are, of course, the terrorists, again, this thing that is now a kind of person, not a tactic. But actually, one thing that's been revealed pretty clearly to anyone who cares to look about the war on terror is that it's not about weapons of mass destruction, it's not about terrorism, it's not about liberation, it's certainly not about democracy. And I think that a series of those examples that Anand mentioned about particularly that warlord Matiula, the Australian forces claim to be liberating Afghanistan from such people while actually training his forces. And I think that, at the same time, though, as Matiula was our guy, There's a cultivation of a deep reservoir of prejudices against Islam and against people from the Middle East in general. And it's been a key part, I think, and continues to be, despite the pushing to the side, if you like, let's never speak of Iraq again, of course, if you're an imperialist, but the pushing to the side of the wars themselves to a fair degree, a key part of imperialism's legitimisation of its domination of the region. And I think the effects are pretty horrendous. I mean, obviously, this encourages Islamophobes, like the Australian terrorist who murdered over 50 people in the Christchurch mosque, but that actually is not its main aim. Justifying these crimes against humanity has required the creation of a hysterical climate of fear. I think the stoking of Islamophobia, the demonising and criminalising of Muslims have become some of the key means by which the US and its Western allies like Australia excuse both imperialist interventions on the one hand and also excuse a mass offensive against civil liberties at home on the other. And this will be the details of this be well known to all of you, I think. The Bush administration introducing the draconian anti-terror laws such as the Patriot Act in 2001. And part of that, we have to be clear, was not just to terrorise Muslims, but also in part to intimidate domestic opposition to the war. And governments around the world followed suit, seizing on an opportunity. And I think the thing that Anand began with about how revealing this is of how anti-human the ruling class is, how little they care for human beings, that they saw that mass death after the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon as an opportunity to increase state powers, to further spy on and repress their own citizens, all of it under the guise of fighting terrorism. And how's this worked out? Well, I think this would all be much less effective if it was just at the level of legislation and police powers, or even if it was just at the level of being promoted by the right-wing Murdoch press, although I do want to say a few things about them. Who could forget the Daily Telegraph's dogged campaign against that terrifying Muslim activist, Yasmin Abdul-Mateen, in 2017? Because she made a seven-word Anzac Day tweet. She said, "Lest we forget, Manus, Nauru, Syria, Palestine." That's a bloody excellent tweet. And that provoked no less than five front pages and more than 100 articles in News Limited papers. But let's not give all the credit just to the right-wing media. I think the liberal media have got a great deal to answer for in terms of how the war on terror has been promoted. The liberal media co-created this decades-long campaign of Islamophobia with their good Muslim, bad Muslim brand of racism, all of it to justify Australia's military interventions in the Middle East. And I think the liberalism of the humanitarian interventionist method of supporting imperialist war, usually summed up in the phrase, "something must be done." That phrase, when I hear it in politics, always makes my blood run cold, because usually when they say something must be done, they're talking about and the Australian or US state or some other a state actor must do the something. And I think particularly in relation to Afghanistan, the something that must be done, the combined with Islamophobia, meant generally, "oh yes, we're liberating women, don't you know?" Which strikes me as particularly appalling coming from speaking from the uniquely anti-sexist culture of Australia, currently now on display. But I think this has played a key role, this kind of liberalism, the humanitarian interventionist liberalism, the good Muslim, bad Muslim, see, we don't hate them all, kind of liberal racism, has played a key role in making the racism of successive Labor and Liberal governments more palatable. But I don't just want to talk about Australia. I'm actually going to talk more about France, because I think the question of Islamophobia has been posed particularly sharply there. And just recently, the end of last year, the horrific killing of the teacher Samuel Paty. The French government launched a renewed offensive of Islamophobia in reaction. The National Education Minister suggested that anyone who denounces Islamophobia should be seen as part of the camp of Islamo-leftists, guilty of intellectual complicity with terrorism. There's that useful word again. While Emmanuel Macron spoke of the importance of unity against, in his words, those who cultivate hatred of the other or Islamists that would steal our future. And so for 20 years, Islamophobia has been used to divide in France, more so, I think, in other countries, largely because the left has been so weak on the issue. And I think this is worth saying a little bit more about. In 2004, the law which banned headscarves amongst high school students encountered no serious opposition from the radical left. Demonstrations attracted a few dozen people only. In other words, the left abandoned its duty to defend oppressed groups. And most of the left supported the ban. Some far left activists, individuals, ran campaigns locally to extend the ban to parts of universities, while their organisations, deeply divided, did not stop them. I think France also provides a useful example of the link between the demonisation of Muslims to justify invasion and war and attacks on civil liberties and how the two things link up. One of the first pieces of legislation passed under Macron in 2017 was an anti-terrorism bill that codified in law a series of measures that had already been introduced as state of emergency by the previous president. It gave the police the power to conduct random stop and frisk searches, greater capacity to raid homes, to place suspects under house arrest with very little oversight. And his law also empowered local authorities to close places of worship, this is a quote, places of worship in which are disseminated the writings, ideas or theories that provoke hate, violence, hatred and discrimination. Now, while you ponder the hypocrisy of that particular statement, I want to move on to a bit more about this question of mass surveillance and the suppression of civil liberties, because, of course, it's linked to the question of Islamophobia, but it can survive on its own. From the outset in Australia, Islamophobia has been a great excuse for the suppression of the civil liberties of one group in particular, that is refugees attempting to come to this country. Starting with mandatory detention, that's a pretty severe suppression of your civil liberties, and particularly as mandatory detention has become more and more long-term, and the myriad of abuses that take place once you're in that detention. Islamophobia after 9/11 was a big factor in acceptance of these abuses for refugees trying to come to Australia. 2001, those poor refugees that happened to be on the Tampa that were picked up and basically made evil incarnate because of the time of their arrival. But of course, it's not just refugees, although they are at the sharp end of this. Those few journalists, and there are very few, who dared to challenge the official narrative have faced repression as well. Julian Assange, as I mentioned earlier, the raids on ABC offices, the referral of the ABC journalist, Dan Oakes, to the Director of Public Prosecutions for his 2017 Afghan files stories. Now, of course, all validated in the government's own Brereton report. And I think round after round of increased police powers and so on have continued. It's not just the frenzied atmosphere that followed the 11th of September attacks in 2001. All of this has been introduced under the guise of preventing terrorism. And today we have to say that Muslims remain the target of relentless attacks in country after country. And it's turned out to be very useful wherever you are in the kind of world geopolitical pecking order. If you've got Muslims, then it's fine now to attack them. You need only the Uyghurs. But while Muslims remain the target of relentless attacks, the targets of the witch hunt can rapidly shift and have done in Australia. And this is not a complete list. Supposed African gangs, bikies, out-of-control youth, building workers standing up for their rights as unionists, Aboriginal activists, environmental protesters, left-wing extremists, probably some of them in this room, single mothers, the famous welfare cheats, or these days, random Chinese people damned as agents of the Chinese Communist Party. So inevitably, these powers will be used against anyone the government or the police or big business or the media see as a threat to their system. The final thing I want to talk about is the anti-war movement, because I think to talk of the war on terror, you have to talk about the incredible mass demonstrations, tens of millions of people across 600 cities in mid-February 2003. But we also have to note that those demonstrations, the largest anti-war demonstrations ever in history, failed to stop the war. And despite the New York Times said at the time, these demonstrations were reminders that there may still be two superpowers on the planet, the United States and world public opinion. But unfortunately, world public opinion didn't cut it, because despite the size of the protest, they lacked the social force, most obviously mass strikes, that would have been necessary to stop US imperialism at a point where imperialism was intent on remaking the Middle East to control its oil reserves as part of a project that a project to take on not just the people of the region, but to take on its imperialist rivals, emphasising its military power and so on. One issue for the anti-war movement, though, fairly quickly, was a liberal failure to grasp the nature of US imperialism. That is, to put it briefly, there are no good wars where these people are involved. And the central role within US imperialism played by the Democratic Party. And so, for example, the most important liberal anti-war coalition in the US, United for Peace and Justice, effectively shut up shop in 2008 with the election of Barack Obama, because they believed that he would end Bush's wars, when in fact he dramatically escalated the war in Afghanistan, massively expanded drone warfare. And I think that this question of the aim of electing Democrats as the way to oppose wars and so on is fundamentally wrong. Not just funneling anti-war activity into trying to elect them, but then narrowing demands and speakers of the anti-war movement to those that will be acceptable to the Democratic Party machine. And I think related to this is the failure to include opposition to the war in Afghanistan as part of the whole war on terror. There are lots of people that were quite willing to oppose the war in Iraq, but for whom the war on Afghanistan was the so-called good war for which Democrats were actually campaigning. When he was a presidential candidate, Obama called himself a strong supporter of the war in Afghanistan. Instead of trying to influence the Democrats, what was needed was to expose the Democrats' commitment to pursuing US global hegemony. And finally, just to conclude, I think the response of socialists, and this relates again to the question of the mass democratic uprising in Syria, the response of socialists must be to oppose all imperialist interventions, including those of imperialisms that are not our own. I mean, at the very point, really a shameful day, really, for the left, when as the Syrian rebels were under attack by Assad, by Russian airstrikes, by Iranian proxy militias, anti-war campaigners were at best shamefully silent, at worst championing the tyrant Assad and deriding the rebels as jihadi head choppers and other Islamophobic slurs. And so the response of socialists has to be to oppose all imperialist interventions and to build solidarity with the movements for the revolutionary transformation of the Middle East, not with their capitalist ruling classes. So to finish, this war was never about delivering democracy or protecting human rights. It wasn't then, it isn't now. It was always about expanding US power. The US states saw an opportunity to occupy, to reshape the Middle East in order to control its oil reserves and thereby to gain leverage against its imperialist rivals and to ensure, at least they thought so, to ensure the future profitability and dominance of the US economy. That one didn't work out so well either. Everything in its legacy is just further evidence of the need for clear revolutionary socialist politics to resist such onslaughts in the here and now, but also to build a movement to overthrow capitalism in its entirety. But I want to end with those big demonstrations in 2003. Despite the failure to stop the war in Iraq, the 2003 protests indicated the immense capacity of people to show international solidarity in spite of the considerable divide and rule efforts of our governments that I've tried to outline. They also demonstrate that for all the horrors capitalism inflicts, people are more than capable of resisting the system. Our rulers can lie, they can scapegoat, they can repress, but inevitably the brutality of their system also inspires rebellion. I'll leave it there.